This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When she was an undercover operative in the CIA, Valerie Plame Wilson's best friends didn't know the real story of how she made her living. But when she was outed in a column by Robert Novak, the world knew. She and her husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, believe her cover was blown by officials in the White House as payback. A year before, Joe Wilson had been sent by the CIA to Niger to investigate the claim that Iraq had tried to purchase yellowcake uranium there for its nuclear weapons program. Wilson found no evidence of such a transaction. Then in the 2003 State of the Union address, President Bush said these now famous 16 words: "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." On July 6, 2003, Joe Wilson wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times titled "What I Didn't Find in Africa," where he asked the question, did the Bush administration manipulate intelligence about Saddam Hussein's weapons programs to justify an invasion of Iraq? On July 14th, Robert Novak revealed in his column that Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, was a CIA operative. Patrick Fitzgerald was appointed as special prosecutor to investigate the leak of her identity. Vice President Cheney's then chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, was convicted of lying and obstruction of justice, but no one has been convicted of the actual leak. Valerie Plame Wilson has a new memoir called Fair Game: My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. Valerie Plame Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, the story of the leak of your name might strike a lot of people as being over. Is it over for you?
Certainly not, because for the first time in nearly 4.5 years, finally I get to tell my story. And everyone else has been, literally in the world, has been talking about it. So it feels very good to be able to speak finally, find my own voice, and be able to tell, I guess it's a cautionary tale of the consequences of speaking truth to power and the importance of holding our government to account for its words and deeds.
What parts of the story are not over for you?
Well, there are still two open cases. One is our civil suit, which was dismissed primarily, as I understand it, on procedural grounds, not really on the merits of the case. So we are appealing, and it will go further up. And then there's also the case against the CIA on First Amendment grounds that, as you may know, the agency has taken the position that I am not permitted to acknowledge my agency affiliation prior to January 2002. So we felt that that went well beyond their purview of safeguarding national security, and we have filed an appeal in that case as well.
Your book has large portions that have been redacted by the CIA. Any
That's
CIA
right.
employee has to submit any manuscript to the CIA before publication, and they have the right to insist that parts of it be omitted because it might violate
Indeed.
National security. So I'll give you an example of how your book is redacted. On page 132, you write, "Back again at headquarters, I threw myself once more into the business of finding and getting intelligence on Iraq." That sentence is followed by 5 redacted pages. 5 pages of just blanked out words.
Yes, how incredibly frustrating. I would say the vast majority of the redactions are due, in fact, to this bright line position taken by the agency that I cannot acknowledge my number of years of service to my country. There are some that were redacted on national security grounds, that it's, you know, too detailed or reveals sources and methods. I, like every other agency officer, when you come on board, I signed a secrecy agreement, which I fully expect to uphold, that I will not reveal classified information. I take exception, though, to this notion that my years of service is somehow classified, and thus the case.
Now, are you not allowed to speak about the things that you're not allowed to write about? In other words, if you can't write about it, does that mean you can't speak about it either?
That's what I take away from it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you refer to a civil suit that you are appealing. This is the suit against Scooter Libby, Karl Rove, Vice President Cheney, and Richard Armitage?
Yes, that's correct. And we filed this suit last July, and for 3 main reasons. And I'll back up just a little bit. When Joe and I were discussing whether or not we should do this, and believe me, some of those discussions were at very high volume, Initially, I had no desire to go down that road because the episode was already so painful and I didn't want more. But as time went on and I saw what some of the fallout was from this really what I would call a treasonous act of betraying my covert identity, there was threats to my family, the loss of my career, a sustained campaign of character assassination. You know, as the losses mounted, I thought that maybe this was a way to go. So when we finally did decide to file, and we had some very long, deep discussions about this, we did it for three reasons. One, get to the truth of the matter. We were promised in Mr. Libby's trial that both Mr. Libby as well as the vice president himself would testify, and they did not do that. So we really want to get to the truth of what exactly happened. How did this come about? Secondly, we want to make sure that government officials, the senior administration officials responsible, are held to account for their actions. And finally, it's a preventive measure so that future administration officials do not believe that they can disregard the public trust placed in their office by using it to unfold a political vendetta. And that's what we believed happened.
My guest is Valerie Plame Wilson, and her new memoir is called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. How did you first learn that your identity as a CIA agent had been outed?
Joe came into our bedroom very early the morning of July 14th, 2003, and he threw the paper on the bed, and he said, well, he did it. And I knew what he was talking about, and opened up the paper and read it, and it just felt like I got a sucker punch to the gut.
And
it really
what
took my breath away.
What you'd read was Robert Novak's column.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in an instant, I'm thinking of the network of assets that I had worked with. How are they placed in jeopardy? I'm thinking of my family security. At the time, we had 3.5-year-old twins. And I knew, of course, my career as I knew it was over.
Now, you told the House Committee hearing on oversight and government reform last March that the leak, quote, jeopardized and even destroyed entire networks of foreign agents who in turn risk their own lives and those of their families to provide the U.S. with needed intelligence. Lives are literally at stake. Mm-hmm. Do you know for sure that that entire networks of foreign agents were jeopardized and destroyed?
There was a damage report done. I did not see it, nor do I believe any members of Congress, but I have to assume that there was certainly negative fallout from this. But what's, I think, even more insidious in what happened, take my case aside, is that for potential future human sources of intelligence who might want to cooperate with the United States government, they've taken a look at this case and go, huh, why should I jeopardize my safety and that of my family? They can't even protect one of their own. So maybe I'll just go talk to the Russians up the street.
Well, speaking of protection, you think that the CIA should have done more to protect you. What could they have done either before or after you were outed to protect you?
Well, I will tell you that in the spring and summer of 2004, it was a crazy period in the run-up to the presidential election. We were receiving many threats, but one was particularly of concern, and it also targeted not only me, but Mr. Tenet, the then CIA director, Mr. Ashcroft, then Attorney General, as well as Mr. Rove. And that was sort of the final straw for me because it seemed to be quite serious. And I went to the head of CIA security and I requested for a limited period of time to have some security on my residence where I felt most vulnerable. And Joe and I always said, well, you know, whatever happens to us, but we are responsible for small children and their safety. And so I felt that deeply. And I recognized what the resources would be to do that, but it wasn't for an indefinite period of time. You know, I thought maybe just through the elections. And they declined to do so. And I was crushed, absolutely crushed, because the agency makes a big deal out of, oh, we're all one big family. And in fact, they hadn't come through when I really needed them most. And I thought, as I write about in the book, actually quite bitterly, that the other potential targets, Tenet, Ashcroft, Rove, they already had 24/7 security. And I didn't.
Why do you think the CIA declined to provide you with that security?
I have no understanding of why they made that decision. It was a poor one.
You know, when you were outed, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, big deal. She hasn't been undercover for a few years. So, you know, and she wasn't that deep undercover even when she was undercover. So what's the big deal? How would you respond to that?
Well, you don't have to take my word for it. The director of the CIA, General Hayden, special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, the judge in the Libby trial, all of them confirmed that I, in fact, was covert, undercover. Fitzgerald made a filing where he said I had traveled under a variety of covers and aliases, traveling overseas, doing operational work quite a few times in the run-up to the war with Iraq. So there was no question, this notion that somehow everyone on the Georgetown cocktail circuit knew where I worked is absolute nonsense.
What can you tell us? I know there's a lot you cannot tell us because the CIA doesn't want you to, but what can you tell us about some of the undercover work that you did before you were outed?
Well, I'll speak now about the work I was doing on the task force, which was convened in the aftermath of 9/11, when, as we now all know, that there was increased focus and energy directed toward Iraq and in its alleged WMD programs. And I eventually served as their chief of operations in directing worldwide cases and operations against the Iraqi scientists in these programs. What we were trying to do was gather human intelligence, good intelligence, that we could then provide to the policymakers so they could make wise decisions. And we did that in a variety of ways. And that was, frankly, part of the job I loved. Operations can be very creative. How do you get to your targets? Obviously, getting inside Iraq was extremely difficult. So you had to find clever ways to still find and talk to these scientists who presumably would know something about the state of their either nuclear, chemical, or biological programs.
So did you work with the agents inside Iraq who were trying to do that?
Yes. We didn't always do it there, though. Sometimes we had to wait for them to come out to international conferences. And that's always a knife's edge, trying to find them and keep them away from their security watchdogs and so forth. Or in other cases, they had relatives in other foreign countries that we would speak to and then try to get messages or information out that way.
One of your jobs at the CIA was getting information on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program. It was your job to get the information, but not to analyze the information and figure out what the significance was. You know, you weren't supposed to interpret it, just
right.
Get it.
Just get the facts.
One of the subjects that you had to get information about was the aluminum tubes that Iraq had imported. And the Bush administration was saying these aluminum tubes were going to be used as centrifuges for nuclear reactors, and these aluminum tubes were evidence that Iraq had an active nuclear program. Now, from your perspective, was the information that you were getting on the aluminum tubes evidence that Iraq had an active nuclear program?
As I write about in the book, it's perfectly normal for there to be professional debates about intelligence that comes in. But this particular case on the aluminum tubes sort of bubbled up above the regular volume because it really became a full-throated battle between the different intelligence agencies or different parts of the community that were looking at the same evidence and reaching different conclusions. It raged over quite a long period of time. There was an analyst in the CIA who felt very strongly that these were, as you say, going to be used as centrifuges, that they were finely milled cylinders that could only be used for that. And there were other dissenting views, just as strongly placed, that in fact these were replicas of an Italian-made rocket, so for more conventional artillery. And what I condemn in my book is how this debate, and it is a perfectly valid debate, and I can't speak to, you know, any of the actual analysis of it, but the debate is healthy and it should be there, but it was completely relegated to really small font footnotes in the National Intelligence Estimate and other important pieces of paper that the president and other policymakers were looking at.
You mean the fact that it was a debate was relegated to a footnote?
Exactly. And what the argument that carried the day was the CIA argument that these were, in fact, for centrifuges, and we found out later that is not the case. In our task force, that was not our job, frankly, to analyze the intelligence. Ours was operational, you know, get to them, where are they coming from, where are they going to, can we get a look at them in between, that sort of thing. So at the time, I did not take any position, I don't have the expertise to be able to do so, on what these could ultimately be used for. But as has since come out, a lot of papers and discussions about this very strong debate within the intelligence community, and it appears that I believe that the CIA was negligent in not putting that in a very straightforward way to the policymaker so they could understand that there was serious doubt within the community. You know, it was a contentious subject on what these would be used for.
Did you ever feel while you were at the CIA that the intelligence that you were gathering was being cherry-picked or spun inaccurately by the Bush administration or by the CIA?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, up until Secretary Colin Powell's speech before the UN in February 2003, making the case for war, my head was deep in the operational weeds. I was very concerned about running secure operations, good operations, getting to the right people, you know, very much involved in the detail of it all. And a lot of the rhetoric was going right over my head. But when I watched Colin Powell's speech, and I knew what intelligence he was referring to in several of his cases, of his examples, as I call it in the book, I was experiencing cognitive dissonance because I knew what he was claiming to be sort of true and factual and robust was nothing of the sort. In particular, the whole case of Curveball, that was far from credible intelligence and certainly not good enough to base a war upon. So that was, for me, the turning point was when I started stepping back and going, what is going on here?
No, what you're referring to here is when Colin Powell said that Iraq had mobile weapons labs.
Biological weapons labs, yes.
Yeah, and what you're referring to is that Colin Powell said that Saddam Hussein had mobile biological weapons labs. That information came from a source nicknamed Curveball. Nicknamed such, I think, because he was so unreliable. You say he was drunk, and that he was famous for being unreliable. He was discredited, and yet he was used here, you say, as the one and only source.
On that particular yeah,
story.
I was shocked, and I just kept thinking to myself, I hope someone way above my pay grade is getting intelligence and information that is underpinning this, because what I know, and I was privy, I did have a position of responsibility. What I was privy to was not matching up to what I was hearing on the TV, and I was horrified.
So what do you do in a situation like that? You're hoping that there's somebody higher up who has corroborating evidence, but you don't know whether they do or they don't. Is there someone, like, what do you do? Do you ask around? Do you express your concerns to your superiors? Like, wait a minute, there's nothing I know of that supports this?
Well, during the broadcast, I turned to the woman that had followed the Curveball case much more closely than I. I said, what's going on here? And she was just looking at the TV screen with sort of her jaw open going, I have no idea. But don't forget, in the CIA, there's the cardinal rule of need to know. So you just can't believe that the government would distort or twist or cherry pick things that was really hard to take in. So I had to believe that there was credible intelligence of an imminent threat, because that's what the administration was saying. And we know now that was not the case.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Valerie Plame Wilson. She's written a new memoir called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. The book is about her life before and after she was outed as a CIA operative in a column by Robert Novak. The investigation into the leak of her identity concluded with Louis Libby's conviction for lying and obstruction of justice, but no one was convicted for the actual leak. Now, you've described you and your husband as being the victims of a smear campaign. The major part of this is that you were outed, you believe, in retaliation for the fact that your husband, Joe Wilson, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times challenging the Bush administration's assertions that, you know, that Saddam Hussein had gone to Niger to buy yellow cake uranium for to be used in the process of making nuclear weapons. And your husband had been sent to Niger to see if that was true. And he came back and said, no, it's not true. But the president went with that information anyways in his State of the Union address. So, okay, if you were the victims of a smear number one, you were outed, you think, in retaliation against your husband. What are the other things that would come under the category of smear as far as you're concerned? Because in your mind, it doesn't end there.
Well, it really reached a fever pitch during the Republican National Convention in July of 2004 when Republican operatives would literally send out blast faxes to media outlets calling my husband the talking points for the day, calling Joe Wilson a liar, a traitor, and worse. And we do believe that that was sort of the precursor of the swift boating of John Kerry. It really was McCarthyite tactics. And it's been 4 years of a smear campaign that has, you know, denigrated our character, accused me of nepotism, and so on. You know, what they never seem to acknowledge is that George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, called my husband a true American hero for his work in the run-up to the first Gulf War. He was the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein. He arranged for the safe release of hundreds of Americans' hostages. And he was brought back, and in front of the whole war cabinet, he called Joe a true American hero. But they never seemed to remember that.
Now, as you mentioned, you were accused of nepotism. You were accused of choosing your husband, Joe Wilson, to go on the trip to Niger to check out these claims that Saddam had tried to buy yellow cake uranium there. Tell us the story the way you remember it of how your husband was chosen to go to Niger.
In February of 2002, a young officer who worked for me received a phone call at her desk, which in itself highly unusual, but from someone in the vice president's office, I don't know who, asking about more information. There was interest on behalf of the vice president about this allegation that Niger was sending yellow cake uranium. There had been a transaction to Iraq, which, if proved true, would be very serious and would show indications that Iraq was seeking to restart its nuclear program. So she came to me very flustered. And I, too, was nonplussed because we have, in the intelligence community, established protocols, standard operating procedures for policymakers to reach back down into the intelligence apparatus and, you know, get more information. You don't ring up someone at their desk. But just as we were sort of mulling this over, a reports officer walked by and he heard this and he said, well, what about sending Joe? What about Joe? And the reason he suggested Joe is because he was fully aware of Joe's credentials. Joe had lived and worked in Africa, all over the continent, for over 20 years. He had served as the chargé d'affaires at our embassy in Iraq in the run-up to the war, the first Gulf War. And in fact, he had, just a few years previously, he had done similar missions for the CIA on these sorts of issues. So, you know, I just kind of looked at him and said, let's go talk to our boss about this. So we brought our boss up to date, and he said, well, Val, when you go home tonight, can you please ask Joe to come into headquarters next week? We'll bring together the people we need to bring, talk about this, and see what we're going to do. Oh, and by the way, send an email to the division chief, let him know what's going on. And it was excerpts from that email that were pulled out later and bandished about as proof positive that I had, you know, sent or recommended or suggested Joe, when that's not the case. And anyone who knows anything about West Africa would not conclude that a trip to Niger free, Joe's only his travel expenses were paid, could be considered a boondoggle or a junket.
So your email to the division chief telling him about your husband's credentials for this trip to Niger, this email was quoted in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence during their investigation into the leak of your name and pre-war intelligence on Iraq. And this was used as evidence that you initiated the idea. And you say it was taken completely out of context, and also that, as you just told us, the whole idea of sending your husband, you say, was not your idea. When your husband found out about this email that you'd written to the division chief, he was furious with you. Why was he so angry with you?
Well, honestly, I had totally forgotten about this email. I, like everyone else in the world, probably send hundreds of emails in a day. This was totally standard. I was simply alerting my division chief to and reminding him who Joe was and why my boss, lower down, had suggested that we bring Joe in to talk to him about this. You know, does it make sense for him to go to Niger? So Joe was so furious, I mean, by, of course, the content of the SSCI, but this caught him unaware. And I didn't remember, I didn't tell him because it didn't seem important at the time. And it really was, don't forget, this is the same time period, just attacks are raining down on us, Joe taking the worst of them by far. But it was such a terrible time. He felt that he had been out there publicly defending me. He was very, very gallant about it. And I was not permitted to say anything. I was still, of course, an employee of the CIA. And even though he knew that intellectually, it hurt him terribly that I wasn't able to come to his defense in any way. And as I write about in the book, at a certain point he says, well, are you putting your loyalty to the agency above our marriage? Which just killed me, but because that wasn't the case at all. But it was such a dark time when you're just being attacked. We're not perfect, but we try to live good lives. And reading this stuff about us in the paper just seems so surreal.
I'm wondering, since you forgot this incident that became a very significant story after the fact, did you relate in any way during the special prosecutor's investigation of the leak of your name? Did you relate to any of the witnesses who were your opponents but said, gee, I don't remember. I can't answer that because I don't remember.
Well, my response to that would be that it wasn't a one-time incident. So many of the witnesses, and certainly Mr. Libby himself, there were multiple occurrences. His defense at one time seemed to rest on that he had a faulty memory, but it wasn't a one-time thing. He had, as we now know from the trial, apparently he had put together a three-ring binder on Joe Wilson in May and June of 2003, tracking him, watching him. And that sort of idea that he doesn't remember is, you know, kind of falls apart. And there was a moment in the trial when there was one witness, John Hanna, I think an aide to Mr. Libby, had said, well, you know, he does have a really bad memory, but he's got so much going on. He's so much going on. So Mr. Fitzgerald gets up and talks to the witness and says, well, Mr. Hanna, would you say that if Mr. Libby took 2 hours out of a day to meet with someone on this issue, that that would be important? And, of course, what he was referring to was Mr. Libby meeting with Judith Miller, I think, over breakfast for 2 hours at, you know, a downtown Washington hotel. And it was just such a I call it in the book, a Perry Mason moment. Of course it was important. He's got a lot of things going on. But for him to take two hours out of his day to speak to a reporter about this, yeah, it's just not believable that his memory failed him on all these occasions, all these points.
You know, we were talking about how there's a lot of tension between you and your husband when you had to testify before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and he thought that you handled the whole thing about the memo badly. You say in your book that you and your husband almost separated during that period. What kept you together? And I guess I'm wondering if part of what kept you together was this thought that if you separated, it would have been a victory for the other side.
Absolutely. Sometimes that's the only thing that works. It was a very dark period. Again, it wasn't something internal to our relationship. These were all these external forces coming from all directions. You felt like you're in the outfield and you didn't know where that ball was going to come next. And it was just such a difficult period. And the tension, you know, between us, there was just way too much to absorb and to take in. But you're right. We did come to that decision that, you know, we weren't going to give anyone the satisfaction of parting ways. And I mean, when we met, it was love at first sight, absolutely. And that sustained us through some of the really darkest hours. And I would say, for sure, now we're in a much stronger and better place. Joe and I were kidding the other day that, in fact, we're ready to celebrate our 35th wedding anniversary because we've packed a lot in. You know, it's been an action-packed marriage. We've covered the waterfront.
Now, no one was actually charged with the crime of intentionally disclosing your identity. Scooter Libby was just charged with lying to the grand jury. Mm-hmm. Is there someone you think should have been charged?
Well, I want to clarify one point. Mr. Libby was also charged and convicted of obstruction of justice. And what that means is, of course, that you can't get to the bottom of things. As the special prosecutor said, it's like throwing sand in the umpire's eyes. So he wasn't able to get to what exactly happened. And the law as written, it's called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, IIPA. Clearly, there's loopholes in it that did not allow the special prosecutor to apply perhaps the full force of what he knew to the law as it's written. And I'm hopeful when all is said and done, perhaps Congress will revisit that to make sure that this sort of thing never happens again in the future.
It appears that the first person to give your name and out you to the press was Richard Armitage, who was at the time Deputy Secretary of State, and he mentioned your name and that you were undercover to Bob Woodward mm-hmm. in June of 2003. So for some people, that's kind of, well, game over. It was Dick mm-hmm. Armitage. That settles that story. Does it settle anything for you?
Well, but that totally misses the other facts in the case. Name one, let me start with Armitage. What a foolish thing to do. He had been around Washington literally for decades. How reckless and how careless to toss around my name when he knew it was associated with the CIA to reporters. I mean, and he apologized for that, but, you know, that's not good enough. He should have known better. Now, the fact that there was a parallel conspiracy within senior administration officials in the White House is not precluded by the fact that Armitage spoke separately to, I think, both Mr. Woodward and Mr. Novak. And the special prosecutor said in his filings, I think of April 2005 or 2006, I guess, that he doesn't know of what evidence would exist to disprove a conspiracy among a multitude of people in the White House to undermine and discredit Joe Wilson. So I think you have to look at all the facts, not just some of the facts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Valerie Plame Wilson. Her new memoir is called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. When your husband, Joe Wilson, wrote the now famous op-ed in the New York Times saying that the Bush administration had misrepresented what he found on his trip to Niger and that he found on his trip to Niger that Saddam had not been there looking for yellowcake uranium, but President Bush, in his State of the Union address, said that he had. When your husband wrote this op-ed piece in the New York Times, did you have any reservations about it? Did you think that this could lead to exactly the kind of situation that it led to?
No, absolutely not. Call me naive, but I never expected that one of the reactions would be the outing of my covert identity. We were prepared, of course, for pushback from the administration, and Joe was prepared with his many letters, personal letters from George H.W. Bush and the pictures showing him in the Rose Garden and so forth, and the cable that calls him a true American hero. He was all prepared for that. And let's not forget, he had more than the credentials and bona fides necessary to have made this trip. And he had every right to speak out on this debate. And so he had something to say. There were very few voices out then, and you know, with the drumbeats to war. But he was in the public debate, and it had nothing whatsoever to do with what I was doing professionally. I was living my cover, and it had been very secure until then. And I had no reason to believe that, in fact, their retaliation would include such a devious act.
The mission that he was sent on to Niger was a CIA mission. By writing the op-ed in the New York Times, was he revealing any classified information?
He did no such thing. He performed a service for his country by going to Niger and checking this out at the behest of the CIA. He was asked a serious question by the office of the vice president, and it deserved a serious answer. Don't forget...
But was the information classified?
No, it wasn't. Don't forget. There was no there. The title of his article was What I Didn't Find in Africa. There was nothing classified whatsoever in that op-ed piece.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Valerie Plame Wilson. Her new memoir is called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. For years, before you were outed, you were using the name Valerie Wilson. But when you were outed, it was under the name Valerie Plame. Have you gotten to the bottom of that story, why Plame was used and not Wilson?
No, that's a good question. When I first read Mr. Novak's article in July 2003, that struck me as well. Why did he use my maiden name, particularly since I had used my married name, Wilson, which I took because it was so easy to say and so easy to spell. I was really puzzled by that, and no, I have never, I think there is still a mystery of how exactly my name was transmitted from the CIA to Vice President Cheney.
You say to Vice President Cheney, and you're mentioning Cheney because?
Because in the trial, I think the prosecutor showed pretty conclusively that it was Mr. Cheney who gave my name to Mr. Libby.
What questions would you most like to ask the vice president?
What were you thinking? What did you know and when did you know it? But I doubt I will have any opportunity to say anything to the vice president, so that's all just hypothetical.
But in the meantime, you're suing him.
Yes, we are. Yes.
You're appealing the suit that was...
Correct. It was, as I say, dismissed on procedural grounds. The judge understood very clearly that a wrong had been done, but he was grappling with how to get his arms around it in a legal sense, because there is some innovative legal thinking here, that is primarily that the executive privilege bestowed to the president, we believe, does not also cover the vice president. So I believe that the judge probably thought that this would be decided by a much higher court than his, and sort of punted.
What the judge said was the alleged means by which defendants chose to rebut Mr. Wilson's comments and attack his credibility may have been highly unsavory, but there can be no serious dispute that the act of rebutting public criticism, such as that levied by Mr. Wilson against the Bush administration's handling of pre-war foreign intelligence, is within the scope of the defendant's duties as high-level executive branch officials. In other words, it was like their job to fight back.
Right. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think I can say in colloquial terms that our legal team would argue that, no, in fact, it's outside of the scope of your office, the public trust, to pursue political propaganda, to go after someone using your office. And, yeah, unsavory indeed.
One of the things you write about in your book is becoming a mother. And after years of working for the CIA, and after years of having to be, you know, pretty tough, and not work in such a way that people could accuse you of being less professional or less strong because you're a female, then you became the mother of twins. And suddenly you were you felt very vulnerable, and underwent pretty serious postpartum depression as well. And, you know, that must have been such a
shock.
Shock, yes, right. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, I thought that I had demonstrated a fairly high ability to cope and adapt to new situations up to that point in time. And here I was completely undone by two tiny little babies. And I'm so glad I got to write about that in the book because I had a happy marriage. These babies were very much wanted. We had financial resources. I was educated. And yet I had never heard the word postpartum depression until a friend, you know, mentioned, well, maybe this is what's going on. I had no idea. I was just completely undone. And it was really scary because I'd always been in control. I was a very independent woman. I couldn't wait to have these babies. I was 36 when I had them. And it was just a whole new world where I was clearly not on top of my game. And it was frightening. It wasn't until I went back to my doctor, and it was like a light bulb went on over my head. First time I had heard that word, and that's exactly what was going on. In my case, it was 100% chemical, exacerbated by serious sleep deprivation, as every new parent understands. But when I finally figured that out and got professional help, then I was on my way, and I learned a lot about it.
You know, in spy movies, when women agents are recruited, they're often asked to seduce their target in order to get intimate and therefore find out the target's secrets. Was that ever expected of you in the CIA?
You know, Terry, a lot of my job was like James Bond, but not that part. Really.
Was there sexism within the agency? Was there a double standard for men and women?
Oh, absolutely. But it's no different in that regard than I think any Fortune 500 or law firm or any large organization. It's unfortunately the way the world. Women have come a long way, but you still face subtle sexism. It is there, absolutely. I think I write about in my book, when I got to my first job overseas, my boss asked me to come into his office the first time, and I was, you know, really nervous and excited to see him and sort of, oh, reporting to duty, sir. And he had his feet up on his desk and he was smoking a cigar. And he said, "Wow, turn around." You know, and he made that little twirling motion with his finger. And I thought, what does he want me to do? Twirl around. So I turn around. And he said, yeah, you'll do. And it turns out that he obviously hadn't gotten the memo on how to treat female employees, but he turned out to be a very good boss who was very caring, and I learned a lot from. So, you know, it's just part of it.
Well, Valerie Plame, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Valerie Plame Wilson's new memoir is called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.